so I think we live in an era where myths have become reality. And I'm thinking specifically of the Greek myth of Narcissus, the guy who fell in love with an image of himself in the pool as he was walking along. And he became so obsessed with his own image, he lost interest in everything else. And it has a pretty sad ending. That killed him. His self-obsession ended up killing him. Now, I think this is the age of self in a very unique way. The age of self in a unique way. The great Mona Lisa. Yep. Selfie. Humans have always been selfish. From Genesis 3 onwards. But never before has any human society, any human civilization organized all of reality around the self and made the self central to everything. And I call this phenomena ego paganism. It's a new form of paganism, the self at the center of everything. So I want to very quickly, it's quite a big thesis, look at the rise and development of this self-centered reality that we live in today, draw some of the implications of it. But I want you guys, as media experts, to kind of draw the conclusions out for the world you're in. And I'm going to be taking notes, listening in. I want to be part of the conversation, but it'll be over to you then. So I want to develop my argument along four lines as a picture of how we got to this point and the implications in terms of how it impacts our experience today. So first of all, I want to think about the world of the self-centered we live in, the origins of this self-centered universe where we've put ourselves at the center of everything. Now, the story of how we got here would fill volumes and volumes and volumes. I'm going to tell it very, very briefly. For a new center to come in, the old centers have to be removed. And these old centers being removed ultimately resulted in the removal of God from the center. Now, I like to trace this along various lines. One is, I think this process began with what we can call the disenchantment of nature. So as the new science, and I would say very much influenced by the Christian worldview, as they penetrated the natural world, they discovered it wasn't enchanted. It worked much more like a machine. And that, in the end, dismantled metaphysics. There's no supernatural realm. This is where the conclusions ended up. It took them a long time to get there. The supernatural is consigned to the realm of the arts. It's not in the real world, so we began to see everything in a more materialistic way. And that led in the end to Friedrich Nietzsche's famous pronouncement, God is dead, and beyond that, and you've killed him. This is what we've colluded in to create the new center. So a continent that had centered itself around God, even if it didn't lead to evangelical faith, but God had been at the center for hundreds of years, where belief in God was 100% plausible, now he's removed. And this gap had to be filled. And I would say, for lots of reasons, there was nothing left to fill that gap, given the disenchantment of nature, but the self to become central. So here comes the age of humanism. Lots of different forms of humanism. The one we're in today is secular humanism, which is the establishment of a whole new organizing principle. Now, humanism in the 16th and 17th century coincided with an unleashing of human genius. So it made sense to put us at the center, all our technological, scientific achievements. It really was a golden age. And these factors birthed this ego-pagan framework we're in, where the gods are not in nature, and the personal living God that the Bible reveals, who transcends the world, he's first sidelined and then removed. Now everything is centered in us. In the full flush of the Enlightenment, who knows where it started, who knows where it ends, but I'm going to say the full flush was the 19th century. The philosopher Feuerbach said, men will become a god to each other. I'd say at that point it had already happened. And a little later that century, Charles Swinburne, a famous 19th century English intellectual and poet, wrote A Hymn of Man. And the chorus, the refrain, glory to man in the highest, for man is the master of things. Great expression of the self at the center of everything. Now, There were seeds of destruction from the very beginning. And this is the point I'm going to really drive through. Is we may be gods to each other. We may have mastered everything, or so we think. But in this rise of the self to the center of all things, there's one thing we didn't consider. In a self-centered world, there's no basis for determining the meaning of the self. You always need something beyond yourself for meaning. Now, Pascal, Blaise Pascal, the 16th century prophet at so many levels, saw what was going to happen. He said, humans did everything. That's Swinburne. Mastered everything, except two little things. Secure the position of God, and thereby the meaning of man. I love that typical Pascal. They did everything. They forgot to secure the position of God and the meaning of man. And that's the crisis we have today, as I hope to show you. We're going to return to that. And it's interesting to see where we are today about the meaning of man. We've gone from Swinburne, glory to man in the highest, to the a sentence from the late Stephen Hawking, the great physicist from Cambridge. What did he say? The human race is just a chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet. Quite a shift, isn't it? So that's the origins of the self-centered world. There's volumes there. I want to think now about how this world we created became a self-determined world. If the self is at the center of everything, it falls to us to determine how this world should be. We have authority over it. We determine it. That's the prerogative of the gods, far back we would said we'd be to each other. So no longer is it about finding your place in a world made by God. Now we determine how it should be. And the secular age is all about constructing the world. Today, social constructionism, in a sense, this is where it's landed. It's up to us to construct the world. And in lots of ways, we determined a rather new reality. The two I'd mention is, first of all, the establishment of a new moral order. For hundreds of years, the ego-pagan project has been determining, step by step, in sometimes contradictory ways, the shape of the morality that we're meant to live by. And increasingly, this has removed itself from the moral framework that the Creator reveals in the Bible. And I actually think this is part of the trajectory. As we wanted to determine the world and use our autonomous freedom, we've done that more and more against the norms of the created order or the natural order. I think transhumanism is the perfect expression of the self, transhumanism and transgenderism, of the self-determined world. It's detached from the creation order. The other thing we did in terms of self-determination is we established a whole new view of heaven. What is human flourishing? What is the supreme good that we reach for? Well, no longer is it heaven, being with God, seeing God as he is. It's now a totally this world focus and something we achieve by our own efforts. We create the heavenly condition. We create utopia. And it's really interesting that the beginning of this ego-pagan project back in the 16th century, that was the heyday of the utopian novel. Thomas More is the most famous, but lots of utopian novels written back then. This is our utopia. We're going to make it. Now again, here's where we need to pause just for a moment to think about what wasn't determined. What wasn't determined is the self and the place of the self and the meaning of the self. The really big question that we could never properly secure in terms of self-determination is the meaning of ourselves. And I would say the great failure of the last 400 years is our failure to find a secure identity for human beings. And that's because with the self at the center of reality, we set ourselves up for a perpetual identity crisis. Modernity is full of delicious ironies, and they're not really delicious because they're tragic ironies, really, but ironies when you abstract them, you love them. Well, this is a tragic irony. We've never put so much effort corporately and individually into finding our identity, who am I, and at the same time never being so lost as to who we are. That's our conundrum. Now the reason for this, and we can't go into much detail, this is, I think, a good argument to be made that the self can never know the self. We are subjects. Our eyes point outwards. We are the subject. We can see and deal with the objective world outside of ourselves, but it's pretty murky when we begin to look inside of ourselves. Augustine, I'm a great mystery to myself. Nietzsche, we are unknown, we knowers, to ourselves. He saw it too. The subject can know everything with some degree of determinacy, but knowing ourselves is a notoriously difficult thing to do. Now, I love the book by Walker Percy, Lost in the Cosmos. Actually, for media people, this is genius, absolutely genius. And Percy starts with a thought exercise. He asks the question, Lost in the Cosmos. He says, if you look at a photograph, a group photograph, and you're in it, who do you look at first? I've done this test hundreds of times, and no one's ever told me otherwise. I always look at myself first. Why? I mean, you live with yourself 24 hours a day. You've probably seen yourself in a mirror about 1,000 times today. So you look back at yourself. Is that really me? And I have to say, I've seen one photo, we're here in media now, one photo of myself out of thousands that I thought, that's me. Every other one didn't quite capture me. The self can't know the self. Percy says, when you meet a stranger for the first time, at one level you know them better than they know themselves. That's quite disturbing. I mean, they don't know your history, they don't know your internal struggles, but in terms of a way of signifying you, they see your face. None of us have ever seen our faces. We've only seen backward images of our faces in mirrors and photos. That's quite significant. But I see your faces as they are. You've never seen your face. You can see the tip of your nose if you do that. But that's about as much of your face that you get a glimpse of. So the self, and there's lots of literature on this today, a recognition that the self is incredibly fragile. Very fragile. So we're in a double bind in the age of self-centeredness, the ego-pagan age. We experience the fragility of ourselves that destabilizes, so we try the harder to secure ourselves in some way. But that doesn't seem to work. And Walker Percy's thesis is that in the end we become ghosts. The more we try to secure ourselves by looking internally, the more ghost-like we become. Interesting. Right. So, thirdly, I want to talk about the world of the self-consciousness, the world of self-consciousness. Beginning, how do we get to this self-centered state? Very brief summary. And then the issue of self-determination, mention morality, mention our new view of utopia, but the struggle, how do we determine ourselves? Well, here we need to come to another dimension of our ego-pagan experience, is that we have become highly self-conscious. Soren Kierkegaard, one of my favorite quirky philosophers. He's a quack, but he's good reading. Kierkegaard made this point in lots of different ways. Moderns have become so highly self-conscious in a way we haven't been in the past. We're so aware of ourselves. Now, one of the beauties of self-consciousness is self-awareness, that we can think of ourselves in first person. I did this and this, and we can look into ourselves. I think there's a healthy way to do that. But self-consciousness is a very delicate matter, as is the self. Because if you become too self-conscious, you tip over and you get lost inside yourself. I call this the modern introspective condition. And the consequence of becoming too self-conscious because you're trying to determine your own identity and you tipple into extreme self-consciousness and you get stuck there. And that's why today I think for many reality is much more in their own subjective awareness, impacting how we view truth, than it is out there. My 21 years at La Brea, another lesson is people have just lost touch with the real world. They were so lost in themselves that the connection, the real connection, the connection of what philosophers call alterity, I relating to that which is beyond me, that's almost lost. Reality is much more in than out. And that throws everything off kilter. And one way it throws things off kilter is that what's in us as consciousness, it is mental. That's all it is. It's wonderful, but it's not reality. It's thinner than the real world that our consciousness is meant to help us engage with. And the thing is, if we get stuck there, we're going to start tumbling in our own self-consciousness. It's the reason I think many today, especially of a younger generation, get caught in what I call the paralysis of analysis, stuck inside their internal world with no way out. They find it hard to make decisions related to reality because they're in their heads. Something, again, 21 years of Libri, saw people so stuck in the realm of their own subjectivity. And that's a tragedy. At one level, theologically, we could say that this is one of the greatest demonic or devilish outcomes we've seen in all of history, because we were made for the other. And to twist that around, oh, terrible, terrible. I've done a manuscript that covers all of this, and lots of poetry in it, although I'm told it's hard to get permissions for poetry. My editor hears it's very hard, very expensive. So we're going to have to do some more rooting through that book. But so much poetry expresses this. I love T.S. Eliot. He describes the modern self as filled with fancy, just filled with them internally, and empty of meaning. Wow. And I think for so many, that is true. Filled with fancies, empty of meaning. So the last stage, we now have moved into the world of the self-referential. We built collectively this self-centered way of arranging all of reality. Then we determined everything from the center, although we couldn't determine ourselves. We tippled over into extreme self-consciousness. And now we deal with everything self-referentially. So this obsessive self-consciousness of modern persons leads to a reorganization of how we deal with the real. Now, every individual self is their own personal center of the universe, and everything has to be referenced back to me. Me, my selfie, and I. I saw a t-shirt that I thought summed it up perfectly, blazoned across. I think you do your best cultural apologetics through t-shirts. I have a little notepad and I write them down. This one was perfect. All roads lead to you. Perfect. Perfect. Now this works in two ways in terms of the use of the metaphor. The first way the self-referential works is that we use the world outside of us as a mirror. All it is a mirror. And what do mirrors do? They bounce the self, reflection of yourself, back to you. That's why we use mirrors. Boom. Ooh. You don't look so good in the morning, Andrew. So it's a self-reflector. That's what mirrors do. And that's the nature of the self-referential experience. Everything is brought back to you. This is what reality is for, to bend it to your purposes. That's its function. And I think a lot of this is actually tied up with the issue of our identity. Our identities are so insecure, we've become increasingly thinned out and ghost-like, and we compensate for that by using the world outside of us as a mirror to get some kind of message back that secures us. So I use the example, you walk into a room of people, rather than saying, Philip, Caleb, seeing you for your own unique existence separate to mine. Philip has a little bit of a frown on his face. He doesn't like me. Oh, I feel bad about myself, but you're smiling? Oh, you like me. But it's no recognition of you separate to myself. We use other people like a mirror as a kind of feedback loop. And I think in a self-referential world, we can do that with almost everything. In a sense, I think this is the real zombie film of our times. We're zombies, we're half dead, and we use the world outside of us to kind of try to build us up, make the ghost live. I think this is the real dystopian world we live in. We started with the utopian framework. This is the dystopian world we've landed in. This doesn't feel good, is it? This is a feel bad lecture. I'm sorry.
Give us the feel good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, because we need it. Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There's another metaphor, and maybe here we get to media. I've used the mirror, but I want to change the metaphor now to the glass house, living in glass houses. I think this excessive self-consciousness has actually impacted our ability to relate to people in a real way. I, you. So we feel very alienated. We feel very alone in this world I'm describing. This world of the self that we've internalized is a lonely place to be because it's only you there. I'm doing lots of work on shame at the moment, how this feeds into that. Shame is brilliant for actually locking you into the room on your own, keeping in hiding. So you're alone in the universe of yourself. Now, the only way to survive that is to build a glass house around you. And why is this house made of glass? Well, we have to keep inventing, constructing new identities of who we are. And these have to be curated to people outside our glass house. We curate them. And we keep curating them. Apparently someone told me there's something called social media. I'm a bit behind the times, but curating of the self. Yeah. Just keep posting. From your glass house, just keep posting. Not just keep swimming, just keep posting, just keep posting. Endless acts of self-curation from within the glass house. And this is where media today functions so powerfully, these self-curations. Now, of course, curation is only one side of the equation. Your curation only works if someone perceives you. They have to like you. They have to push the button or use or misuse language in what Byung-Chul Han calls the pleasant pact of coexistence, which means use hyperbole. You're amazing. You're awesome in terms of how we come back. I do that with my kids. You're a hypocrite, they say. Dad, you use emojis too. I mean, how else can we communicate? But the point is, we curate, someone has to perceive us, they have to see it. Even if they haven't looked at our photo, if they mark it. So they've seen me. I exist. I love Charlie Brooker. You like Charlie Brooker probably, don't you? I think he's one of our better comedians, very thoughtful, irreverent at times, but he did something in the Guardian newspaper some years back on how Twitter and Instagram work. And he says, there's never been a social media interaction that isn't about self-authentication. Never a tweet, he said, never an Instagram that couldn't be replaced with, please authenticate my existence. So he suggests that we reduce all of our Twitter exchanges to a series of beeps. He says, why do we use words at all? So you would go to you, I'd go beep, which when translated means I want you to authenticate my existence. And then you go bip, bip, existence authenticated. But you also say in the second one, please authenticate mine. So I go beep, you're authenticated, end of discourse. Very clever. He says that's how they tend to work. Back in the 16th century, it's part of the rise of the ego-pagan area. I think, therefore I am. That's changed today to I am perceived, therefore I am. I am perceived, therefore I am. I'm going to leave it there. Because I don't want to get overwhelmed with information